evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry. Civil rights groups called for President-elect Donald Trump to forcefully and publicly denounce racism and bigotry. They point to more than 860 bias-related incidents recorded in the 10 days following his November 8th victory. Richard Cohen, president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, says one of our great hopes at the Southern Poverty Law Center is that Mr. Trump mightily disappoints the white supremacists, the white nationalists who are celebrating his victory right now. Civil rights organizations want Trump to make true on his promise to be a president for all Americans and publicly denounce the bias and hate-related incidents that popped up around the country. One survey of more than 10,000 teachers told the Southern Poverty Law Center they knew of more than 2,500 fights, threats, and other incidents related to election rhetoric, and they reported an increase in slurs and derogatory language, swastikas, Confederate flags, and Nazi salutes. This afternoon, members of the Revolution Club, in protest over Donald Trump's denouncing a First Amendment right saying nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag, are burning the flag. That's at Columbus Circle in front of the Trump Hotel and Tower. Carl Dix of the Revolutionary Communist Party tweeted, "In the 1930s, Hitler made defacing swastika a crime. Trump wants to criminalize flag burning. Hashtag fascism." Meanwhile, members of the New York City Council are intent on not normalizing Donald Trump's presidency. Queens Councilmember Danny Drum.
So I'm committed to resisting every aspect of the Trump administration's agenda. I believe that it's racist, misogynistic, Islamophobic, all of the isms. And I don't see any value coming out of this administration. His appointments so far have been horrible. They have been frightening. The education person that he put forward is a huge charter school voucher supporting person. This needs to stop, and we need to resist in every way humanly possible.
And so what do you expect people to do? What do you want them to
protest,
do?
Protest, organize, write letters, demand that our senators and our Congress members represent us in the Congress of the United States, and make sure, to the extent possible, and I know it's going to be hard because the Democrats are in the minority, but to the extent possible, to raise all of these objections against this Trump agenda.
New pics from Trump so far don't indicate any draining of the swamp, as the president-elect promised. New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito is very concerned over voter intimidation. This after the president-elect made clear his opposition to recount efforts in up to three states led by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. He also falsely claimed that millions of people had voted illegally in the presidential election. He provided no evidence and has continually sought to throw doubt into the electoral process.
He's lying.
Mark Viverito.
The news wants to talk about allegations. It's outright lies, and it has to be reported as outright lies. And what he is doing is undermining our democratic process, and it's a prelude to what I believe is going to be continued voter suppression efforts by the Republicans. That is without a doubt what's happening. We've seen voter suppression efforts have success in other areas and states, and how communities have been targeted and focused, particularly African Americans, Latinos, et cetera, people of color, communities that historically have more of an inclination towards the Democratic Party. So what I think he's doing is being explicitly clear, right, about what he intends to do. And when you talk about a Sessions being considered as Attorney General, he's making it explicitly clear of what his intent is. And that is to continue to support that kind, those sets of laws and policies across this country, and we can't stand for that. There's obviously, our concern is to uphold a democratic process, and we need to ensure, what I am concerned is about the voter suppression efforts. That is what I'm concerned about. That is where you're talking about efforts that are very clearly aimed at suppressing vote in particular communities. That is anti-democratic. So that is what we should be concerned about. But if you can point to me, in terms of specific examples here in the city of New York or others, where people have voted illegally, you're gonna, if there is any example of it, it would probably be minuscule, or probably just not even a blip on the radar. So these are you know, falsehoods.
And what about the cost to the city to protect Trump? The number that's been put out there for security is $1 million a day. That's $364 million a year. Even half of that amount, according to the speaker, is unsustainable. She says the federal government needs to step up, and she reinforces what the mayor has been saying about policies in place in the city to support immigrants here.
We in the law, in the legislations that we've adopted here in the city of New York, that has to do particularly with city employees. Police officers fall within that. You know, correction officers fall within that in terms of the amount of information and data that is shared with ICE agents, for instance. So we've been taking we've done a lot of research, looking at the legal ability that we have of what to do in terms of sharing. Those are things we're going to continue to explore if there's other avenues legally that we can take up. Obviously, yeah, I mean, that's the problem with the laws. The ICE out of Rikers legislation that we adopted was because we were not interested, right, in becoming deportation agents of sorts, right? And especially when you talk about low-level offenses, really not interested in seeing families ripped apart, children that are more likely than not U.S. citizens, and their parents having to be sent abroad and breaking those families up. We didn't want to be a part of that. We should never be a part of that. So we took real interest in looking at the legal avenues we had available to us, and we're going to continue to explore that moving forward. So yes, those are concerns. We've looked at it, we've addressed it in our own way, and we might figure out if there's ways to expand that.
One effect of the election has been for the City Council's Women's Caucus to come together to enact legislation which protects crime victims and offers services. Bronx Councilmember Vanessa Gibson is a member of the City Council's Women's Caucus.
I think obviously in light of the election that, you know, has propelled a lot of residents across the city with action in different ways. So I think, you know, obviously our timing is very appropriate for the very reason of making sure that we as a body of, you know, the City Council, but certainly the Women's Caucus of 14, we wanted to make sure that we were very clear, we were very bold and very aggressive about our agenda of fighting for all women and children, seniors and everyone.
A new legislative package by the Women's Caucus includes Gibson's bill relative to the Rikers Island Nursery.
Because I think, you know, women who are unfortunately incarcerated that happen to be pregnant are also entitled to services through this city. So I'm very happy that this bill was chaptered into local law signed by Mayor de Blasio and also Councilmember Julissa Ferreira Copeland, the feminine hygiene package as well, making it free in our schools and public places like our city's jails. So for me, this is just not just a call to action, but it's making sure that we're firm in our position. The election doesn't change our position, it doesn't change our passion, and it certainly doesn't change our priorities. But what I think the election will do and has done for many of us, especially women and women of color, is it's highlighted the work that remains to be done. The fact that we have an incoming president that is talk so openly about assaults on women as denigrating women is really appalling. It's very disappointing.
And what it's brought many women out to speak about their experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, what is the message we send to our young girls growing up? That you can be respected by your president and everyone else.
The new package of legislation establishes a new Office of Crime Victim Services to combat domestic violence.
So we just want to make sure that as a city, we are doing our part. We can't do it all, but as a city, we can do a lot, and we will make sure that we invest in these programs, and that priority does not change on Election Day.
And one of the things that you're trying to assure people is that there is a place to go if they are a crime victim.
Yes, because we know many of our crime victims obviously have a lot of challenge with working with NYPD. Many victims of domestic violence, of sexual trauma and assault. So we wanted to have a coordinated effort where all of the services, the Mayor's Office to Combat Domestic Violence, the NYPD, all of those services are put together in one entity where you can get access to emergency contraception, health care, transitional housing. I think the struggle I have as a council member representing the Bronx, many of my victims are victims of crime, and they're initial priority is getting out of the neighborhood. They need to move. They cannot live in the same neighborhood where their child was shot and or killed, and they have other children that they're raising. But they can't easily just say, I'm leaving, right? Many of them are stuck in those communities. So what I'm hoping this new office will do is provide an expedited process to access emergency housing when you have a Section 8 transfer, because the NYPD cannot do it. And so we want to give them the support. We want to complement the work they're doing. They have a new program, a three-year program they're embarking on, Office of Crime Victim Advocate that they're doing with Safe Horizon. So every police precinct will have a DV advocate as well as a social worker paid for through the city by Safe Horizon. So that's great, because we want to make sure that we're doing all of this work with the same goal, and that is to protect all victims of crime and their families.
Councilmember Gibson says the office should be up and running within a few months. And this is the news on WBAI in New York. Our commentary for this evening is from feminist and writer for Revolutionary Newspapers, Sansara Taylor.
It's impossible to overstate the danger of the Trump-Pence victory to women. I'm not talking about an undesirable but incremental rollback of women's rights. I'm talking about a brutal beatdown, intended to leave women bloodied and bruised, nursing their wounds in humiliated silence while cradling the rape babies they'll be forced to bear. No, I am not exaggerating. Trump is a walking, talking embodiment of rape culture, of vindictive revenge, of cruel degradation and violence against women. He brags about sexually assaulting women. He lashes out at women who complain, fires them, smears them, sues them, works hard to hurt them in any way he can. He relies on and has whipped up to new levels the sense of entitlement that men have for centuries been socialized to feel over women's bodies, lives, psyches, and aspirations. Already, women and girls as young as elementary school across the country have reported being grabbed by the genitals by strangers and classmates in the name of the new president-elect. Mike Pence hails from the most extreme wing of the Christian fascists, what could accurately be called the American Taliban. No birth control, no sex ed, no sex before marriage, no abortion, even if the woman is raped or in danger of dying. Pence fought to protect the, quote, right of businesses to discriminate against same-sex couples, to prohibit trans people from using the bathrooms that fit their gender identity, and to back anti-scientific, cruel programs that torture gay kids into being straight, or try to. And this is where the cold moral rectitude and theocratic shaming of Mike Pence comes together with the crude, womanizing predations of Donald Trump. Both reduce women to objects, to be owned, used, and controlled by men. This must be stopped. We must fight with every fiber of our being for a world in which women are treated as human beings, full human beings. But in waging this fight, it is not enough to merely try to stave off the most monstrous things that Trump unleashes against women, as well as immigrants, black people, the environment, Muslims, and people around the world. Fighting to keep things the way they are now is not only impossible, it's intolerable. The status quo is and has been convicted rapists getting only a slap on the wrist. It has been Christian fascists terrorizing women outside abortion clinics. It's already universities filled with rape culture and violence against women. And it's a global network of exploitation and plunder. Women locked in sweatshops in China and Bangladesh. Women forced into sexual slavery in the brothels that surround every U.S. military base in the world. Women imprisoned under veils, stoned to death, or burned with acid by the rising forces of Islamic fundamentalism, which the U.S. has massively strengthened through its invasions, occupations, torture, and drone strikes. All of this must be ended. We must stop Trump's fascist America. We must fight to do so. And as we fight, we must bring alive the culture of mutual respect and equality between women and men, between people of different genders and sexual orientations that we are fighting for. We must value the lives of people around the world as much as our own. We must fiercely oppose the terror that's being unleashed against black people, Latinos, Muslims, immigrants, and native peoples. And we must lift our sights to the kind of real revolution that can build a future where there is no longer the basis for anything like this to ever happen again. Break the chains. Unleash the fury of women as a mighty force for revolution. For WBAI, this is Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, www.revcom.us.
Taylor is hosting a discussion at 7 p.m. tomorrow evening at Revolution Books, 437 Malcolm X Boulevard at 132nd Street. And this is the news on WBAI in New York.
$15 an hour and a union, affordable health care, and justice for immigrants and people of color our movement will stand with thousands of other working class people from communities across the country to fight.
Fast food workers, home care aides, airport luggage handlers, Uber drivers, and other low-wage earners across the country joined a day of protest to raise the U.S. minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour. It's the fourth anniversary of the Fight for 15, which began back in 2012. It's been successful in raising the minimum wage in California and in New York. President-elect Trump has sent different signals on the minimum wage, calling for its elimination one day and supporting a $10 minimum the next. Kendall Fells is organizing director of the Fight for 15. He says voters across the country are not ambivalent.
On Election Day, even as Donald Trump won, all five ballot initiatives to raise minimum wage passed handily. In four states and one city, showing that raising wages is always a winning issue.
Fells notes that the ballot initiatives in Arizona, Colorado, Maine, and Washington all passed with broad bipartisan support. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Today in the Senate, Democrats press for changes to a $6.3 billion medical research bill. This as Republican leaders try to push it through the lame duck session of Congress by next week. Opposition to the bill is from Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren. Both complain that the bill's money is not guaranteed and must be released in later legislation by Congress. They also criticize the legislation's savings. They include cuts in a public health program under Obama's health care law, reduced payments under Medicare and Medicaid, and oil sales from the government's Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Senator Warren says the bill would legalize fraud by reducing scientific evidence the government needs to approve existing drugs for new uses. She said it would cover up bribery, this by exempting medical companies from publicly reporting some payments that they make to doctors. Consumer groups have complained that the money encourages doctors to prescribe those firms' products. Senator Warren urges Democrats to fight, not cave in, and sign a bill which doesn't uphold Democratic principles.
Scientists who invent new cures should be celebrated, along with the companies that support them. But let me be perfectly clear. While the drug industry may get a seat at the table, they do not own the table. I do not care how many armies of lawyers and lobbyists they send out. I do not care how many campaign contributions they dump into congressional pockets. I do not care how painful they can make life for politicians who oppose them. I will not be their lackey. I will work for the hundreds of thousands of scientists and doctors who are committed to saving lives and who are waiting for Congress to fund their work. I will work for the millions of families that have been touched by Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancer, and other deadly diseases who are counting on this research. I will work for the 70% of voters who are sick of a Congress that is owned by big donors and giant corporations. Republicans are taking over Congress. They are taking over the White House. But Republicans do not have majority support in this country. The majority of voters supported Democratic Senate candidates over Republican ones. And the majority supported a Democratic presidential candidate over a Republican one. The American people didn't give Democrats majority support so we could come back to Washington and play dead. They didn't send us here to whimper, whine, or grovel. They sent us here to say no to efforts to sell Congress to the highest bidder. They sent us here to stand up for what is right. And now they are watching, waiting, and hoping that we will show some spine and start fighting back when Congress ignores the message of the American people and return to the old ways of doing business. Republicans will control this government. But they cannot hand that control over to big corporations unless Democrats roll over and allow them to do so. It is time for Democrats and Republicans who should be ashamed by this kind of corruption, to make it clear exactly who they work for. Does the Senate work for Big Pharma that hires lobbyists and people who make giant campaign contributions? Or does the Senate work for the American people who actually sent us here?
Senator Elizabeth Warren on the Senate floor, a possible 2020 presidential candidate. In other news, as last Thursday seems to blur in the past, turkeys were delivered, they were eaten, leftovers are mostly gone, but hunger and the demand for food at food pantries and soup kitchens remains higher now than in the recession, Andrea Sears reports.
Right now, a full-time minimum wage worker with two children in New York earns an income below the federal poverty level. According to Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America, nearly half of all working-age residents of New York City and state who can't afford to buy enough food live in households that include at least one working person.
We know the minimum wage hikes that are going to go into effect over the next few years are going to help, but we're still facing an epidemic of working hungry families.
The survey found from 2013 to 2015, one in seven children statewide and one in five in New York City lived in households that couldn't afford enough to eat. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And this is the news on WBAI in New York. Websites and blogs, Facebook and Twitter continue to receive thousands of messages from people worldwide expressing condolences to the Cuban people over the death Friday evening of Cuba's revolutionary leader, Fidel Castro. In contrast to the overwhelming sentiments of love and respect for this iconic figure, however, the U.S. and other Western corporate media is rife with vitriol against the legendary man who guided Cuba's socialist society for 48 years, with CNN and BBC particularly denouncing Castro as a dictator. Condemnation of this coverage has also been numerous, with one blog in particular pointing out that American media and officials are talking about human rights in Cuba while Washington is running a torture camp, Guantanamo Bay, on the island. Many people throughout the U.S. have also expressed opinions of admiration for Fidel Castro. One such is Dr. Rosemary Mealy. She is author of Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting, recently republished by Black Classic Press. Mealy is an educator, journalist, and internationalist, and former WBAI producer. As part of her solidarity work, Mealy had an opportunity to work and live in Cuba, and decades later returned to seek help for an innocent man on Texas's death row. Yesterday, she spoke with WBAI's Sally O'Brien.
Well, the call came in from a friend of mine after midnight, I guess. My husband answered the phone, and he made some comments like, well, he made great contributions to the world. So when my husband hung up, I said, Fidel died. And he said, yes. And I went back to sleep. So when I woke up the next day, I did not turn the news on.
Lucky you.
Well, I knew that the opposition in this country would be vehemently happy about it. They would be celebrating. And that's exactly what I understand later on was occurring, particularly in Miami and our neighbors in New Jersey. So as the day went on, I reflected a lot on his life. I rarely use Facebook, but I did go on Facebook. I developed a short message of condolence to the Cuban people. And because the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People, ECAP, has been the organization that has been in the forefront of supporting and spearheading all the solidarity efforts between Cuba Solidarity internationally and domestically here in the U.S., I sent that message of condolence to them. And then I started personalizing it, thinking about my encounters with Fidel, which I had a chance to personally be in his presence at least four times, I think, more or less, including photographs. So the other thing that I did, I uploaded a photo of Fidel and I standing together, but personalizing it also from a political perspective, because my experiences with Cuba have all been framed in a political context, not going as a tourist or, you know, just to be there. There's always been a purpose. And it's interesting that the photo that I chose to use on the Facebook page was a photo that was taken in 2000. There was a massive campaign globally around the execution of Chaka Sankofa, who was an innocent brother who was electrocuted or murdered by the state of Texas. And several of us had gone to Cuba to ask the Cubans if they would support us in internationalizing Chaka's case. And I recall Pam Africa was on that trip, Leonard Wineglass, Monica Moorhead. It was a small delegation. And when we met with Fidel, we explained what was going on and also obviously discussions around Mumia's case. But Chaka was shortly scheduled to be executed. So Fidel, through the party, put out a global call to every Cuban embassy in the world with a request that those embassies do as much as they could to raise Chaka's issue. I thought that that was just incredible. Within what we would normally have to do in months, they did it overnight. It was amazing. Just the generosity and the compassion. Fidel left a legacy before he made his transition. There was a stamp on his ideological perspectives, his views, his clarity, using his reflections that were published in Granma Weekly, his voice through his writings and all of that. So while Fidel has made his transition physically, it is my opinion that what he stood for existed already. And so the fact that he's made his transition, those ideals, those views, those orchestrated ways in which he was able to bring together and unify through the Bolivarian views and ideals, he used those views and ideas just because that's Bolivarian, right? And he just embraced those views and ideals the same way that the next generation will embrace Fidel's views and ideas. So I think that if you try to say that it's the end of an era, the way in which the right-wing press is saying, and I mean, I've been reading and we hear on the radio and the talk shows, you know, well, Fidel is dead. So therefore, Cuba is now in a better place to assume, quote unquote, democracy. I mean, that is so undialectical. It just shows a total ignorance of how views and ideas and beliefs that are of truth are perpetuated, you know. It is embraced in the children who have grown up under the revolution. It's embraced in the teachings. It's embraced in our beliefs. And it's what we leave behind. And just because we make the transition from this planet does not mean that that's the end of. And I think if we're not clear in explaining it like that, I think people then fall into the whole bourgeois way of looking at life and what is life about? You know, what does it mean? What does leadership mean? You know, so I don't ascribe to the view that the end of Fidel's physically is the end of Fidel's views, ideals, leadership, and what he stood for.
Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, the other day said, Fidel is a teacher of revolution.
Well, when we say Fidel presente, we mean that he's here. He laid the groundwork and he left behind some tools for us. And how we use those tools, that's the challenge. Most of all, I was always impressed with his discussions around defending humanity. And that's a lesson. Everything that we do should be done in defense of humanity. And that's what Fidel taught me.
Journalist and author Dr. Rosemary Mealy is a founding member of the National Alliance of Third World Journalists. She's a board member of several institutions, including IFCO, Pastors for Peace. She spoke with WBAI's Sally O'Brien. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, November 29th, 2016. The news was produced with Sansara Taylor, Sally O'Brien, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York. And today is Giving Tuesday. Consider being a WBAI supporter and giving to WBAI. Support the news over WBAI. Support this listener-sponsored, non-conventional, non-corporate radio station. Go to give2wbai.org and become a listener member. Thank you.